Yeah. Okay. So this week, I want to discuss a story that we all know in some form or another, and becomes, I think, the paradigmatic story of of unlikely victories. And good morning. The story of David and Goliath, right? And this becomes, it's not just the story of David and Goliath, but the phrase, David and Goliath becomes, it becomes a catchphrase for the underdog managing to win. Malcolm Gladwell has a whole book called David and Goliath, devoted to the underdogs managing to pull ahead at the end of the day. Morse, everyone has? Everyone uses it, right? Everyone, you have? Yeah, right. Everyone uses David and Goliath. This is like the classic story. So what I want to do is focus on that, right? We're focusing on different themes and victories. I want to focus on that. I want to use this as a chance to discuss the role of the underdog, but especially as it appears in Tanakh, because the approach of the underdog is a bit different in Tanakh than it is, let's say, in popular culture. So that's why I called it David's and Goliath. I didn't know how to do it. David's and Goliath's, or David and Goliath, however you want to do it. But and we'll look at least two stories, which are of that genre, let's say, and try to tease out ideas from it. So let's first read the story of David and Goliath. So the background is as follows. You look at the first source. This is from the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 17. So the Philistines assembled their forces for battle. Saul and the men of Israel massed and encamped in the valley of Elah. They drew up their line of battle against the Philistines, with the Philistines stationed on one hill and Israel stationed on the opposite hill. The ravine was between them. So just these first three verses. So to explain what we're talking about and why this situation happens the way it does, so just imagine, right, you're both on mountains, and there's a valley between you, and you're ready for battle. Now, what's the problem? Right, you're stuck in a big problem, right? In order for a battle to be won, it has to be fought, right? In order for it to be fought, the people have to, right, have to come up the mountain, but, correct, right? If you're at the top of the mountain, you're at an advantage, and therefore nobody wants to move. Because right, if you're each on a mountain, whoever goes first will lose because they will be in the valley for a significant period of time, right, where they will be completely exposed. So you have two armies, and they're just staring each other down at the top of the mountain. So what are they going to do? So they come up with a solution. In the ancient world, often, remember, battles were highly structured, and they were... It wasn't like, now the latter half of the 20th century, 21st century, the notion of a battlefield has been thrown into chaos. But traditionally, battles were extremely structured. You met on the battlefield, you fought, you went home. We have historic, anomalies because of this, famously during World War I, when at some point the Germans and the British just played soccer on Christmas. Right, because they just had a truce for the day. Because if it's that structured, so you can make an agreement, then you'll go back to fighting the next day. So one of the weird things that happened, we can't imagine this, but this is historically what would happen, is sometimes in the ancient world, instead of battling, you would say, okay, forget, the battle's just too much. It's not worth it. Instead, let's have a symbolic battle. Let's have a wrestling match between our representative and your representative. It's like the duel, right? We each deputize somebody, they'll fight, whoever wins the battle, right? That's it, right? It'll be instead of actually fighting, whatever, you flip a coin, whatever you want. So the way they did it was a one-on-one duel. So the Jews and the Philistines are stuck because they don't want to go down into the valley and have an actual battle, because once they do that, whoever goes in the valley first loses. So they say, okay, but we still want to fight the battle, so they decide to move to that model, which is let's have a symbolic duel that will decide who wins. But here the Philistines have an advantage, because the Jews, however good their army was, they were, they didn't have one person who really stood out. We'll see if that's true in a minute. But no one who really stood out who could win in the duel. But the Philistines do. They have a 9-foot warrior named Goliath. So that's where we start in number 4. So a champion of the Philistine forces stepped forward. His name was Goliath of Gath, and he was 6 cubits and a span tall. So it's about 9 feet, 9 to 12 feet. He had a bronze helmet on his head and wore a breastplate of scale armor, a bronze breastplate weighing 5,000 shekels. So when I looked it up, it's about 250 pounds. So if you think about who we're talking about, someone between 9 and 12 feet and is capable of fighting wearing 250 pounds of armor. Right? We're talking a very impressive, very imposing figure. He had bronze greaves on his legs and a bronze javelin slung from his shoulder. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's bar, and the iron head of his spear weighed 600 shekels. So that's another 30 pounds or so, right? And the shield bearer marched in front of him. He stopped and called out to the ranks of Israel, and he said to them, "Why should you come out to engage in battle? I am the Philistine champion, and you are Saul's servants. Choose one of your men and let him come down against me. If he bests me in combat and kills me, we will become your slaves. But if I best him and kill him, you shall be our slaves and serve us." And the Philistine ended, "I herewith defy the ranks of Israel. Get me a man and let's fight it out." So Goliath comes down and says, "It's not worth an actual battle. Neither of us wants to blink. Neither of us wants to come down. So let's do it symbolically. You send a champion. I'll represent the Philistines." And that's what's going to happen. Okay, now the first thing to notice is, who does Goliath want to come fight with him? Right? Right, he wants one person, presumably the best, but there's one really logical person to come down. The king, right? Saul. Exactly, that's what I put here in brackets, is that if Goliath is known as tall, so Saul, who's the king, is known, when you first meet him, that he's from his shoulders and upward was higher than any of the people. He was also extremely tall. He was a head taller than anybody else. So the logical person, he doesn't just want somebody, and it makes sense. If this is meant to be a symbolic battle, so the logical person for a symbolic battle is send your king, right? Let me see you have courage. But Saul doesn't want to do this. Nobody wants to do this. And that's the situation we all know, right? Goliath comes out for 40 days, as we'll see, day and night, making fun, mocking the Jews, that no one has the courage to come. But no one wants to come. Why does no one want to come? Because why would you want to come, right? Like, right now, you're just staring each other down. But now, you know, if you are in battle, fine, you have a chance, because, okay, 5 people could take down Goliath, and then you'll fight the army. But here, it's a one-on-one against this, you know, 9, 10, 12 foot monster in duel. Like, you do not want to fight.
And if you lose, everybody else.
And yeah, and it's all hanging in your shoulders. Like, the stakes are really high. It's not like you'll die. It's everything hangs on this. So, the story continues. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and terror stricken. And that makes sense. David was the son of a certain Ephratite of Bethlehem in Judah, whose name was Jesse. He had 8 sons. The 3 oldest sons of Jesse had left and gone with Saul to war, and David was the youngest. The 3 oldest had followed Saul, and David would go back and forth from attending on Saul to shepherd his father's flock at Bethlehem. The Philistines stepped forward morning and evening and took his stand for 40 days. Now, this just highlights what I said about the battlefield, right? The battlefield is highly structured. Everything else is safe, such that, you know, David can go back and forth between the battlefield to bring food. I mean, until they actually engage in battle, everything's pretty safe. But what are the verses emphasizing here? That David isn't just, right, setting the stage. David is not just somebody, but he's the youngest. He's puny. He's, right, there are eight sons. And not just that, if you skip here to number 2, right, I put the whole story in order, but to fully understand, you look at number 2. When Samuel had appointed David as king, and he'd gone to appoint him, this is how the verses describe it. When they arrived and he saw Eliab, the oldest son, he thought, "Surely the Lord's anointed stands before him." But the Lord said to Samuel, "Pay no attention to his appearance or his stature, for I have rejected him. For not as man sees does the Lord see. Man sees only what is visible, but the Lord sees into the heart. Thus Jesse presented 7 of his sons before Samuel, and Samuel said to Jesse, "The Lord has not chosen any of these." Then Samuel asked Jesse, "Are these all the boys you have?" He replied, "They're still the youngest. He's tending the flock." And Samuel said to Jesse, "Send someone to bring him, for we will not sit down to eat until he gets here." So they sent and brought him. He was ruddy-cheeked, bright-eyed, and handsome. And the Lord said, "Rise and anoint him, for this is the one." So when we find out, when David became king, it's not just that he's the youngest of 8. He was so not likely to be a leader that when Samuel came, Jesse, his father, right, Yishai, said, "Look, I have 7 sons. It could be any of them could be the one you want to appoint as king, but it definitely isn't David." Right? And Samuel goes one after the other. He looks at the first one, impressive looking, brother Eliab. And God's like, "Nah, stop looking at physical stature." And the same thing happens with the second son, the third son. In the end, he just says, "You got anybody left? He said, "Yeah, I have, you know, my young son tending it, and he's handsome, and he's, right, what, why, you know, handsome here isn't meant as a pure compliment, right? It's meant as a, right, he's handsome, meaning he, like, he's, you know,
a man.
Yeah, he's a man. He's still gentle, right? He's not like, he's not a warrior, right? He doesn't have scars, like, you know, no bruises, no wounds. Like, he's the youngest one. He's out tending the sheep. No one even thinks of him." And God says, "Look, you look at physical stature, I look at the heart." But we're told that David is like the least likely person to be a warrior. Now, he turns out to be a very impressive warrior later on, but at this point. And this is why this story becomes the paradigm of the underdog versus the strong, because David is described as the young, little, weak, right? No one, his father, doesn't even... His father's willing to entertain it. The other 7 sons could be king, but him, nah, right? But we know David is going to be the one who won. So we've set up this situation where you have Goliath. He wants, really, probably, Saul to come down and fight. Who has a chance? He's tall. He's a warrior. That's not what's going to happen. It's going to be the youngest child in a family that doesn't expect him to be a warrior. And that becomes even clearer as you continue. So we find out that Jesse had said to his son David, right back to our first source, "Take an ephah of the parched corn and these 10 loaves of bread for your brothers. Carry them quickly to your brothers in camp. Take these 10 cheeses to the captain of their 1,000. Find out who your brothers are and bring some token from them." And so David is just, he's the messenger boy, right? He's the water boy. Saul and the brothers and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah in the war against the Philistines. Early next morning, David left someone in charge of the flock, took the provisions, and set out as his father had instructed him. He reached the barricade as the army was going out to the battle lines, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines drew up their battle lines opposite each other. David left his baggage with the man in charge of the baggage and ran toward the battle line and went to greet his brothers. While he was talking to them, the champion, whose name was Goliath, a Philistine of Gath, stepped forward from the Philistine ranks and spoke the same words as before, and David heard him. When the men of Israel saw the man, they fled in terror. And the men of Israel were saying among themselves, "Do you see that man coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The man who kills him will be rewarded by the king with great riches. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and grant exemption to his father's house in Israel." I mean, tax exemption. Now, this story just emphasizes David's the water boy and everyone else is scared. Now, why is this gift being offered? Why is Saul offering this gift? Right? Why his daughter in marriage, probably? Right, to put him in line to the throne. Because again, exactly, but why? Because who should be fighting this battle? Right, Saul, again. So he's saying anybody who takes my place will be part of my family, right? It makes a lot of sense. But now you've set up the scene, because all the soldiers there are terrified. And they're telling them that whoever wins will be the prince. And the water boy overhears this. And now, if we hadn't had the David and Goliath story, this would be unexpected. At this point, this is a trope, right? We expect the unexpected to happen, but This is the first time. This is the first story. So it's not expected yet. It's not really the first story, but it's really the most famous of them. So David asked the men standing near him, "What was that? Right? I heard something. What did you just say? What will be done for the man who kills the Philistine and removes the disgrace from Israel?" I heard a big prize is in order. You want to repeat that for me? Right? Who is that uncircumcised Philistine that he dares defy the ranks of the living God? The troops told him in the same words what would be done for the man who killed him. Right? David starts to get filled with righteous anger and a bit of hope for a reward. And then what do you inevitably have in any story like this? Right? Just to set up the scene, you need somebody who, or you can't just imply that this is an unlikely victory. What do you need? You need someone to say it, right? That's how it makes everything better, right? So, that's what you get in verse 28. When Eliab, his oldest brother, heard him speaking to the men, Eliab became angry with David and said, "Why did you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your impudence and your impertinence. You came down to watch the fighting." Right? You shouldn't even be watching fighting, right? Who's watching the sheep, right? You're just a shepherd. But it is. I actually had at some point included this. But Rav Amnon Bazak points out that, yes, this story is bringing to mind Joseph and his brothers very much, right? They're both sent by their fathers to watch with the sheep. The brothers are the stronger ones. He's the beautiful, handsome lad, right? He's hated by his brothers, looked down by his brothers. He's the unlikely leader who emerges as the second in command, right? Eventually, David becomes king, but starts
the child of Ephraim, who is.
Right, and right. Well, he's from Judah. He's right, Ephrati. He's not Ephraim. Right, he's from. It's very much a Joseph story, and right, Joseph. I thought about talking about the Joseph story, but that's really a precursor to this. That's another story of the unlikely, the runt becoming the leader, and there we even have dreams to back it up. But yeah, right, it's drawing that out. Now, Rav Bazak notes that this is sort of a fixed Joseph story, because while his brothers don't like him, he's never done anything to warrant that. It's not like he wanted to lord over his brothers. There's no dreams, there's no nothing, right? His brothers don't particularly like him, but he's not, and he never takes revenge against anybody. He doesn't even take revenge against Saul, as opposed to Joseph, who has that, period of accusing his brothers of spying, of taking his revenge upon the people. You never hear that with David at all. So it is a Joseph story again, but David is fixing in many ways the sins of Joseph. But David replied, he said, "Look, what have I done now? I was only asking. Look, I'm interested." And he turned away from him towards someone else. He asked the same question. And the troops gave him the same answer as before. But now he does something weird. He asked the same question. Now, why is he asking the same question? Right, he went over and he said to the first person, he said, "What's the gift that you get? What's the prize you get if you beat Goliath?" Right? He got an answer. Then he goes to the next person. What happens if you beat Goliath? Why is he doing that?
He can't believe it.
So either he can't believe it, or, right? It's probably both. Partially he can't believe it, but what else? What else does he accomplish? People are talking about it. Right, he's getting people talking, right? Because he has one person he's curious, but he's now asking everybody. He goes person to person, "What is it?" And they're all like, exactly, right? He wants everyone to start thinking about it, right? Like, this is possible. Someone's going to do it. Now, it's unlikely. He's the unlikely person. But once you start pushing people, what's the prize again? The implication is, well, maybe someone's going to take it up. Maybe it'll be someone else, but maybe it'll be him. The things David said were overheard and reported to Saul, who'd brought him over. But from this verse, it's clear he's not just because he doesn't believe it. He wants people to talk because he wants it to get back to Saul, that there's somebody here who's asking, which makes it sound like there's someone here who wants to fight. So David said, he comes over to Saul, and David said to Saul, "Let no man's courage fail him. Your servant will go and fight the Philistine." And David says to him, "What's going on? Why is everybody afraid? Come on, people, have a little bit of courage. You can do this. And if no one else is going to do it, then I'm going to do it." Right, I'm going to do it. And Saul said to David, you cannot go to that Philistine and fight him. You're only a boy. And he's been a warrior from his youth. Saul says to David, are you kidding me? Right, none of my soldiers are going to do it. And you, right, the water boy bringing food to his brothers, this guy's been training in war since he's a little kid. And look at him. Look at him. He's what, 400 pounds? He's, you know, 12 feet tall. And you look at the picture, right? This is from, I can't even pronounce, Gebhard Fugel, right? He's this massive, imposing figure with a spear that's bigger than David, with this, right, impenetrable armor, and David is a shepherd. He's a shepherd boy. And David says something very unlikely. And David replied to Saul, don't worry about it. Your servant has been tending his father's sheep. And if a lion or a bear came and carried off an animal from the flock, I would go after it and fight it and rescue it from its mouth. And if it attacked me, I would seize it by the beard and strike it down and kill it, or by the mane. Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and that uncircumcised Philistine shall end up like one of them, for he has defied the ranks of the living God. Don't worry, I'm a very good shepherd, and I drove away animals. The Lord, David went on, who saved me from the lion and bear, will also save me from the Philistine. Okay, so now we start to hear something different, though. Just from that line, David says two things. One is I'm a shepherd, and I fought off wild animals, so I can fight off Goliath. And two is God will help me. Those are two things he says. Now, the second one is very important, because the second one tells us that the underdog is not the underdog if what? If God is on his side. Right? And it is clear that, if nothing else, that is going to be one of the key messages from David and Goliath and David and Goliath's stories. Right, is that the underdog is only an underdog if he doesn't have a secret weapon. And if that secret weapon is God, then he's in good shape. But if you think about what the verses have done, is they've built it up to that point. Right? They've highlighted how unlikely it is, by any natural means, that David can win. But then David comes and says, but don't worry, I have a secret weapon. And that weapon is God. Because I'm not fighting Goliath because, you know, for pride. I'm fighting it because every day he's disgracing the people of God. And this is God's problem. And I'm not Saul's champion. I'm God's champion. And he is in my right, he's in my right-hand corner. He is my backup. So I'm not quite as much of an underdog as you might think. We're going to come back in a minute to the other thing he says. The other thing he says is just strange. Right? The second one, I get. That's what a very religious person would say. I'm not an underdog. I'm fighting for God. God will help me. Okay, at least, right, if you accept that theological claim, at least I understand why you think you have a chance. But you're a successful shepherd? Well, that's great. Right? How, even the biggest bear that you have, when was the last time you saw a 12-foot bear with 250 pounds of armor that make it impenetrable? Right? When was the last time you saw a bear who has a 30-pound javelin? Right? I get it, but still, right? So you beat animals. You're not totally pathetic, right? You could tend the sheep, but this is a bit different. But so. Gets it. He gets what David says. So he says, okay, fine. I can't talk you out of it. Then go, Saul said to David, and may the Lord be with you. If you think you're going to win because you're trusting God, then okay. Then good luck, and I hope God is indeed with you. But Saul isn't willing to just to rely on miracles. So Saul says, at least, look, you want to fight a battle? Let's not just rely on miracles. So I'll clothe David in his own garment. He placed a bronze helmet on his head and fastened a breastplate on him. said, but at least let me give you, like, armor. Right? Don't go. Don't go, right? He's wearing, you know, exactly what he's wearing in that picture, right? You know, like that white shepherd's clothing, right? If you're going to fight, at least put on some armor. And then to highlight how unlikely of a warrior is, it tells you that David girded his sword over his garment, then he tried to walk, but he was not used to it. And David said to Saul, I can't walk in these, for I'm not used to them. So David took them off. Now, I'm sorry, I can't even carry it. So this does two things. First of all, it tells you that he's not at all a warrior, right? He's not even going into battle with armor. Like, it sets it up. Like, let's at least make this on the same plane. You'll be a warrior, a new warrior. He's a hardened warrior, but at least you'll be a warrior. And David said, nah, I can't even. But there's something else that goes on. Right, what else is that doing? Yeah? Oh, that's where it came from. Interesting. Right. But that highlights the point, right? People to develop as a warrior, they work out, they get ready. And David, like, we're not at that point yet. He hasn't even started pulling the bell yet, right? He has no upper body strength. He can't even hold the armor. Now, it's not just that he's not a warrior. Who is that contrasting him with, right? Who's it really setting up the contrast with? Goliath, right? Goliath has 250 pounds of armor, and he's ready to fight in it, and David's, like, wearing regular armor, and he's just like, uh-uh. I can't even walk. Forget fight. I can't move. Right? Like, we've set up the two poles as far as they can be. If you remember last week, we did this also, right? We made it clear. The Jews aren't even going to fight. The way we're going to know that God is fighting for the Jews is they're not even going to lift, right? They're not even going to lift a sword. So here, David and Goliath were doing the same thing, right? We're emphasizing how unlikely David is to win. And he took his stick, picked up a few smooth stones from the wadi, put them in his pocket of his shepherd's bag, and sling in hand, and he went towards the Philistine. Instead, he's going with a slingshot. So this is the story we all know. And until now, if you just ask me, okay, what's going on in this story? I would tell you this is the story of the underdog, except it's a theological story. It's purely theological. He's going with a slingshot. The chances he's going to win at this moment are next to nothing. The only reason he's going to win is because God is in the picture. And therefore, the lesson of the story, the lesson of the Jew victorious, is that your victory isn't your own, your victory is God's. Right? That's what if I stop there, that's the classic way of understanding the story. Okay. But has anyone here read Malcolm Gladwell's David and Goliath? It's a fun read. You can also check out this particular point on YouTube. He has a TED Talk on this. And he argues something I think fascinating. He says, I think we've totally misunderstood the David and Goliath story. And he likes this a lot. He started as a secular, totally non-religious person. I think I forget if he's from Toronto or he's from Montreal. I think he's from Toronto, actually. But then he's a born-again Christian, so he likes the Bible. He likes Bible stories. And he said at some point he sat down with David Goliath and he said, I think we're misunderstanding it. And he said, let's think about it. Why would you bring a slingshot to a gunfight? Right, to a sword fight, really. Right? Right, what's the strategy? Right, so what is he doing?
He can, from the distance, attack already.
Right, he can attack from the distance. And what Gladwell points out is that, if you think historically, a slingshot wasn't a pathetic tool. Now think about it, he tells you, he uses it to kill lions. And right, and it was the gun of the ancient world. Right, he's literally bringing a gun to a knife, right, to a sword fight. He's literally bringing a gun to a sword fight.
But it is today also. you always see the Palestinians with their slingshots. As a matter of fact, one of the things that very much annoy me about this whole thing, not that they have slingshots, is that the way it's played up very often in news photographs is this poor Palestinian with a slingshot against a Merkava tank, and they say, oh, look, the big tank and a little Palestinian here. It's a David Goliath story in the opposite, except we're the good guys this time.
Right. No, I mean, they did clearly use that trope. But you're right.
Rabbi,
you're right. The slingshot, yeah. But even nowadays, and you're right, the slingshot isn't a pathetic weapon at all. The reason that people, that you know, when Palestinians throw rocks on the highway, it's so dangerous, right, is because a rock, when you throw it, so it has velocity already, and then you hit it with the car, right, is the same as a bullet. Right? It's the exact same thing as a bullet. So Gladwell points out, well, wait a second. He's coming with a slingshot. A slingshot is just an ancient gun. And he has already told you that he's a good, right? He has a good aim. Right? He has very good aim. And, you know, he said historically, the people who knew how to use slingshots were used in battle, were very, very precise. They were the ancient equivalent of a sniper. And they could spin it around extremely fast, send it at several hundred miles an hour, and they were very precise. So he said, this isn't the case of an underdog. It's a case of a sniper coming to a gunfight with, you know, a laser pointer where he can, from several hundred meters away, aim at the guy's head. And he said, that's what happens. He's like, he's not the underdog. I mean, he is. He's the underdog in a knife fight. But he's not winning this purely by God. He's winning it with chachma, with a bit of intelligence, right? By thinking out of the box. Because why was everyone scared? Because what did everyone assume would happen? And that they would have to fight in a sword fight. You don't want to fight in a sword fight against Goliath, but no one ever said that you couldn't bring a gun, right? But everyone was so stuck in the box that they didn't think to bring a gun. But David said, I'm not going to duel him. I can't beat him in a duel, but I have a gun, and I'm going to fight. And he said, if you read the story, suddenly the story takes on a different valence. And he said, right, continue. He took his stick, picked up a few smooth stones from his wad. He put them in the pocket of his shepherd's bag and slinging hand. He went towards the Philistine. And the Philistine, meanwhile, was coming closer to David, preceded by a shield bearer. When the Philistine caught sight of David, he scorned him, for he was but a boy, ruddy and handsome. And the Philistine called out to David, am I a dog that you come against me with sticks? He doesn't even think about it, because he's so stuck in his box. He just assumes that if David's holding a stick, he must be coming to hit him, right? That he's going to fight his sword, his javelin, with a stick. And he's like, you got to be kidding me. But it doesn't enter his mind that maybe David has no intention of coming close to him. Now, Gladwell and others have had this suggestion. I don't want to get bogged down, but if you're interested, you can look it up online. They argue that it's not just that Goliath is not expecting this. They think Goliath has a particular medical problem with a growth in his pituitary gland, because he said many of historical giants that we have on record have growths on their pituitary gland, which would explain his height. But also, one of the side effects of a growth in your pituitary gland is that you can't see very well, right? Is that you don't have good balance, you don't see very well. So he points out that here, David seems to see sticks, Goliath seems sticks rather than a stick. So he's arguing that the reason that Goliath is the way he is because he has a growth in his pituitary gland, he's really tall, but he also can't see, right? He can't see well, so he sees multiple sticks. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's interesting. And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, come here, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field. David replied to the Philistine, you come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord of hosts and God of the ranks of Israel, whom you have defied. This very day the Lord will deliver you into my hands. I will kill you and cut off your head, and I will give the carcasses of the Philistine camp to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the earth. All the earth shall know that there is a God of Israel. And the whole assembly shall know that the Lord can give victory without sword or spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will deliver you into our hands. When the Philistine began to advance towards him again, David quickly ran up the battle line to face the Philistine. David put his hand into the bag. He took out a stone and flung it. It struck the Philistine in the forehead, and the stone sank into his forehead, and he fell face down on the ground. And so David's very smart here. He's not wearing anything. Goliath is wearing so much he can carry it, but he's slow because he's carrying 250 pounds of armor. And David has nothing. He's running with a gun, and the other guy is lumbering around. Right? He needs someone else to carry his shield for him. Like, he's so overburdened because he thinks he's just going to sit there with his javelin and stick it in somebody, and right, no one's going to be able to hurt him. So he doesn't expect he's ever going to have to move. So David says, so don't move, right? I'll run around. I won't take any armor. I'll be right quick on my feet with a gun, right? Aim at your head, right? He has plenty of time. The guy isn't moving. He can't move. He can barely walk, right? He aims it at his head and he shoots. Now, the people who argued, you know, this scientific understanding that he has this pituitary, disorder, note that one of the side effects is also very weak bones right here, right in the forehead. Right, the front part of the skull is very soft, is very brittle. Right, so they have a whole medical explanation for why this is particularly effective. But even without that, right, it's effective. The guy can't move, and he shoots a gun at his skull. Right, he's a sitting duck. So then, what did he do? Then David bested this Philistine with sling and stone. He struck him down and killed him. David had no sword. Now, David wants to cut off his head, but he didn't have a sword. So now, it's very easy. David ran up, stood over the Philistine, because remember, no one's there. Where's everybody? On the mountain, right? Because they said they do this down in the valley, because no one wanted to come in the valley, so there's nobody there. Everyone's watching from a distance. No one even knows what's going on, right? He's playing on confusion. He doesn't have his own sword. He doesn't bother. He runs over to Goliath, who now is unconscious on the ground, takes his sword, all right? David ran up, stood over the Philistine, grasped his sword, pulled it from its sheath, and with it he dispatched him and cut off his head. When the Philistines saw that the warrior was dead, they ran. Right, they didn't expect that to happen. The men of Israel and Judah rose up with a war cry, and they pursued the Philistines all the way to Gai, and up the gates of Ekron. The Philistines fell mortally wounded along the road to Shaarim, up to Gat and Ekron. Right, and that was it. Everyone's in terror, so the Jews say, hey, right, now we're going to win, and they chase them. We're going to the Philistines should have at that point given up, but that was the deal. But they don't, because they never thought they would lose. So if they're not holding up to their end of the bargain, so the Jews are allowed to fight. That's how it works, right? You're supposed to give up when you lose the duel. They lost the duel, they didn't give up, so now the Jews fight them. But at this point, everyone's in disarray, so they actually win a full-out battle. So what's the message of the story? So one message of the story clearly is, as David himself says, that nothing is impossible with God. That forevermore, the underdog will not be the underdog if he has God on his side. But if Gladwell is right, I think there's a second message, which is not just that, right? Gladwell's message from it, without the God thing, is that the underdog isn't the underdog if he can think outside the box. Right? And he notes that historically, we always think, you know, we've mentioned this before, that the army has the advantage over the guerrilla warriors because the well-trained army has, you know, they're well-trained as a bunch of kids, as a bunch of, you know, but historically, it's actually not true. You know, I'm sure you can argue the numbers, but he says if you look in the last 100 years, battles between big armies and small armies, the big armies tend to win, right? Battles between standard armies and guerrilla armies, two-thirds of the time, the unconventional warriors win. So his message from the story is not about God, but it's think out of the box. And if you want to win, don't play to your disadvantage. Don't let the other person set the terms. Right? That's what, right? Everyone was scared of Goliath because they were letting him set the terms. He wanted a duel. But no, who said it had to be a duel? All he said, it was a one-on-one battle. If you want to win when you're right, disadvantaged, so find a way in which you're advantaged. Play to your strengths. Right? This is like the message of, you know, every other underdog story in history. Right? Some underdog stories are just if you think, you know, if you're smart enough, you'll win. Right? If you try hard enough, you'll win. But some of them are if you think out of the box, you'll win. Right? Like if you think People read Harry Potter?
Yeah.
Yes, some people read Harry Potter. Okay, so the fourth Harry Potter, right? He gets chosen as to participate in the Triwizard Tournament, right? It's supposed to be three. He is the fourth because he gets snuck in against his will, right? And he gets the first match to face the dragon, right? He doesn't know he's going to face a dragon, but then someone convinces him, what should he do? Play to his strength. He doesn't know how to use a spell to kill the dragon, but he knows how to use the spell to summon his broomstick, and he knows how to fly well because he's a good sports player. He plays Quidditch well, right? So he wins because instead of trying to cast spells against a dragon, which he doesn't know how to do, right, he plays to his strength, and he turns into a sports game, right? So Gladwell's lesson from this is, if you want to win, play your strength and think outside of the box, right? Don't let the other person set the terms, because then you really are disadvantaged, right? But play to your own strengths.
There's another element with the organized army and the guerrillas, is that organized armies are generally made up of, used to be just men, let's just stick to that for now, who are conscripted. And they don't necessarily really want to be there. They don't necessarily, life and death thing. Guerrillas are generally made up of people with a drive, with a political and moral, some sort of emotional drive to win. So they are going to fight with this strength that you get because you have the commitment to your country or whatever it is.
For sure. So right, it's not always true that, you know, formal armies aren't motivated. Sometimes they are, but you're right. One of the differences, right, that people will draw is that part of it is about inspiration, right? Is that the underdog can win if only they're more motivated, they're more inspired than the person who should win, right? And that's another thing you could gain from here, or even without the theological element. This happens to be theology here, right? But that David is motivated because God is being disgraced. So maybe part of the lesson is, yeah, if you're motivated enough, you'll win. I would just say that there's no reason that these are mutually exclusive. And I think part of it is, you're right, is that the underdog isn't the underdog if, A, he's motivated, B, theologically, he's motivated by God and realizes that nothing is ever quite as it seems if you believe there's a higher force in the world, and three is just because you have a secret weapon, just because you have God, just because you have motivation, doesn't mean you shouldn't also be smart, right? I mean, part of being the underdog and part of being convinced that you need to win, right? And this is necessity is the mother of invention. But if the necessity is motivation, right? You can't just say, well, I'm fighting for God and motivation is enough. No, the underdog also, like Gladwell says, has to think out of the box. If you think that your side has to win, then set the terms in a way that, right, if it's important enough, then find a way to win. And you think about historical battles that have been fought this way, whether it be the founding of the United States of America, right? The Americans thought they had a divine mission, right? They viewed themselves as the new Israel. They had to win, so they fought to their advantage, right? They knew the turf. They were more motivated, right? The British were coming from thousands of miles away. They weren't as motivated, right? They weren't fighting for their lives and family. They were fighting on behalf of the king. They didn't know the terrain, right? The Maccabees, right? They knew the terrain, right? It was guerrilla warfare because they needed to win, because they needed to fight for God. And time after time, you find that underdog stories, you find more than one element. You find underdog stories without God, where people think out of the box. You find underdog stories where they win because of motivation, but then you find religious underdog stories where people are convinced that they need to find a way to win. They need to think out of the box. They need to find the motivation because they realize that they're fighting for a good goal and God is going to help them. They have a secret weapon. And the David and Goliath story becomes the paradigm as you look throughout Jewish history. I think, right? Jews look back to moments like that, right? The Maccabees, what else is it except for people, it's the same factors, right? It's a bunch of people saying, we need to fight because we need to fight for God, so they're motivated. They believe God is on their side because they're fighting for him. And they realize they can't win in a classic battle, so they turn to guerrilla warfare, right? Whether it be Esther, right, who says, I need to save the Jewish people, right? Mordecai is saying, look, even if it's not you, will be saved because presumably God is behind us. Now, it doesn't mean they're necessarily going to win, but she uses her, right? She uses her wits, right? You think about it. She doesn't just say, barge into Ahasuerus and say, save the people. She sets up Haman, right? She says, she makes him think that maybe Haman is trying to, right, is having an affair with her, just so Ahasuerus will be jealous, right? She invites Haman twice to a party. So Ahasuerus is already, like, the excitement's building up, but he's wondering why Haman is being invited to a private meal with his wife, right? And then Ahasuerus walks out for a minute after she's spilled the beans, and he falls down on Esther's bed, right? And Ahasuerus walks in and jumps to the conclusion that Haman is having an affair with his wife while he's there, which is totally unreasonable. It doesn't make any sense that it's happening now, right? But she's used her wits to set up the scene. Ahasuerus won't be thinking clearly, right? She's using God, she's using her wits, right? And you start to see that all three factors in the David and Goliath story, that people who are the underdogs need to think out of the box, people of the underdog have a better advantage if they're motivated, and people of the underdog have an advantage if they have God behind them. And if you believe in God, right, never should anything be quite as it seems. You see it there too, right? And you see it in, and we'll talk about this in 2 weeks, you see it in the Six-Day War. The Six-Day War was, you know, the many, and you know, and if we borrow Hanukkah terminology, is the, right, many were given over to the hands of the few. But it also wasn't one where they just fought a frontal battle. Part of the reason the Israelis won is because they thought out of the box. They didn't wait to be fought. They destroyed the plains where they were on the ground, right? And especially religious Zionists saw in this a hand of God. And, you know, and Yom Yerushalayim, right, Jerusalem Day becomes a holiday because people believed God was behind it. People thought out of the box, and they were motivated because they were fighting for their lives, right? You can go through Jewish history, and those same three factors you find over and over again. And the David and Goliath story is a paradigm which sets up what it means to be the underdog in a religious context, right? Where, again, you're not really the underdog if God is behind you, but that doesn't free you up. You still have to think out of the box, right? You need, and that's what Gladwell points out. It's not like he fought hand-to-hand combat and God magically made him win. No, he was smart about it. He realized he needed to win, but he also realized that there was no reason he should win in a hand-to-hand combat. It's not his strength. And again, in the motivation point, yeah.
How does this work with the message of last week, where you had to let God was fighting for you, and the Jews really weren't supposed to lift up a hand? I mean, this is almost like an opposite.
Correct. I think that's definitely true. And I think that's what we started talking about last week. It's not that every battle, right? It's not that every battle you have to just let God do it. What we suggested last week is maybe the first battle the Jews fought, right, at the sea, had to be one where they didn't do anything to make it clear that God is behind it. But from then on, even when you recognize that your secret weapon is God, for the most of Jewish history, most of history, you need to put in your effort too.
But Joseph, the story with the weapon and the baker, and Joseph reminded
You're right. So the Midrash sees, you know, Joseph's attempt to use normal political means to get power as a negative, that he should have relied on God. And you're right. Sometimes you'll find statements in the Midrash that will say you should only rely on God. But under most circumstances, right, whether it be, you know, the Maccabees or it be David, the assumption is, even if it is God, and even if you should recognize that the real reason you're winning is God, and that's why you're not the underdog, you still have to come up with a plan. You still have to put an effort, right? If you're right, you have to be motivated, and even if it's very unlikely you're going to win, you have to fight, and, you know, sometimes it's not going to be successful. You don't always know it's going to be successful, right? You know, if you think about the story of Daniel or Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, they don't know they're going to be saved from the lion's den or from the fiery furnace, but they're willing to do it for God. Right, so sometimes you just need to say, I only have motivation and commitment to God. If God saves me, fine. If He doesn't, He doesn't. Right. Sometimes you need to say, I need to come up with a plan. Sometimes you need to say, just let God do it. But even when God, you know, you have a plan, you have to recognize that God is behind you. Right. But I think you're right. Those stories, I don't know if they're intention. They're different models. Right.
Can I just add something? It bothers me that these soldiers know that if David loses, they have to become slaves. And they let this young guy, who looks like there's no way he's ever going to win, go down to fight, knowing that if he loses, they're going to be slaves. And no one...
Yeah, because no one else is doing it.
But no one steps forward. These aren't cowards.
Well, what they are, right? That's really what highlights the story here, is that they're so, right, demoralized. They don't even, meaning they don't have a better hope at this point. And it is scary, right? They're basically willing to, you know, become the slaves of the Philistines because, and it highlights the fact that, like I said before, it seems like what Goliath really wants is Saul to come and fight, who should fight, but everyone else is scared. Right? And they really are. And if someone is willing to do it, do it. And you hear Saul's voice. It's like, may the Lord be with you, right? It's like, they've given up. And they are willing to be slaves. They're just expecting it. They don't see this going anywhere. David is the one who says, no, right? Don't give up. God is behind us. We're not the underdogs. God is behind us. We're motivated. We're doing it for the right reasons. We have a secret weapon. And I'm going to think out of the box because it's so important that we win. But you're right. Everyone else has basically said, if you're willing to try, fine. You know, you're just speeding up the inevitable, right? Like, they don't think they're going to win. So at some point, no one's even willing to put their life on the line. Everyone else is like, okay, you want to do it? At least it'll be over, right? We'll have lost. We can give up, right? It's done, right? Otherwise, it's just, you know, it's going to go on forever, which is even worse than, you know, losing. But you're right. Right? That's clearly part of the sort of pain of this story. Okay. In number three, I don't think we have time to read it, so I'm going to summarize it outside. But another story with this notion that God being behind you makes you not the underdog, but you need a bit of a plan, comes in the story of Gideon. So I'm just going to summarize it. But in Judges, we have one of the most powerful of the judges is Gideon. So Gideon is, the Jews have been oppressed by Midian. So, as often happens in the cycle of the book of Judges, the Jews sin, God allows them to be given over to the enemies, then they repent, and God sends the Savior. So an angel comes to Gideon, and he says to him, look, God, it's time for the Jews to be saved. And Gideon says, how am I going to save Israel? I am the humblest of the... My clan is the humblest in Manasseh, and I'm the youngest in my father's household. Right? It's unlikely of us to beat Midian, and for sure not me. I'm in the smallest tribe, the smallest family, the youngest in my family. Right? Sound familiar, right? This is, right, David, it's actually an earlier story. But, right, same thing. And what does God say to him? The Lord replied, I will be with you, and you shall defeat Midian to a man. Right? The answer is, I'm with you, and therefore, you're not the underdog. You look like you're the underdog. So, then what happens? So Gideon says, okay, fine, and he starts to collect an army. Collects 32,000 rather, troops. So now, 32,000 Jewish troops, even though they don't have as good weapons, still, that's an army. So, but if he fights with 32,000 troops against Midian, so what is he doing? What is he essentially doing? He's fighting on their own terms. Right? Now, on their own terms, what are the chances they're going to win? Very unlikely. So God could say, go ahead and I'll let you win. But then what would people say? Okay, you know what? Usually the bigger army wins, but sometimes the younger, you know, the smaller army wins. God says, no. I want to make it clear that you're not the underdog, not because you're, you know, really good soldiers and you just didn't know it, but because I'm with you. So he says, that's too many. Tell everybody who's afraid, go home. So he says, okay, everybody who's afraid, go home. And 22,000 out of 32,000 leave, right? She's 10,000. And God says, that's too much. I don't like this. 10,000, way too much. He said, here's the test. Go down to the river. Tell your army to drink water. Whoever kneels as if they're, you know, bowing to an idol, right, to lap up the water, send him home. Anyone who just, you know, is willing to just, like, lie down on the floor and just get the water, is not going to do an act of prostration. That's who I want. He's left with 300 men. So, 300 men, and now Gideon's terrified out of his wits. So God said, look, go, send a messenger, go yourself and see what's going on. You'll see, you'll be okay. So Gideon has a spy mission. He goes down to the camp, and he overhears two people talking. And one says to the other, I had a dream last night that a huge loaf of bread rolled down the mountain and crushed our army. And his friend said to him, hey, I know what that is. That's Gideon and the army of God, and they're going to kill us. And Gideon says, well, that's a good enough sign for me, right? And he gets ready to fight. Now, then what Gideon does is very clever. He gets his 300 men. He says, you know, I'm not going to fight in frontal battle. Surround them. He divides up his men, and he puts them at different places around the camp. And he says, each one of you take a torch and take a jug and a shofar, right, and a ram's horn. And when I say go, right, shatter the barrel, the clay vessels you have, blow the horns, and wave your torches in the air. So this is what they do in the middle of the night. And what are the Midianites go into a terror. They freak out, and they start killing each other. They said, oh my God, it's Gideon! It's Gideon! He's here! He surprised us! And they, right? And they start killing each other and run away, and Gideon gets them, and all the other Jews who had gone home, right, see the fleeing army, and they descend on them, and they defeat them. Now, that story has all the same elements, right? Staring into the face, it has the God thing, right? Because God himself said, look, I don't want you to win with 32,000 and not 10,000. I want you to win 300 because I want it to be clear that the reason you're winning is God, right? You're not really an underdog because I'm there. But you also have the two other elements. You have the motivation, right? That's clear, right? Gideon is saying, my people are, you know, oppressed. I need to win. Fine. But the strategy you also have, and this is very clever. The Dot Mikra version of a commentary in Tanakh says the following. He said, how did they win? He said, think about it. 32,000 people is a lot. So if he was amassing an army of 32,000 people, people probably knew about it. How do we know they knew about it? Because when he listened to the guy retelling the dream, he knew that Gideon had an army. But what were they expecting? An army of 32,000 people. If you're expecting 32,000 people, how easy is it for 300 people to get really close to your camp? Really easy, because they're expecting a big army. They're not. If they see a few hundred people, they assume that's not the army, right? So it was very easy for them to get to them, get close. But then, historically, in armies, who blew the shofar? Who blew the trumpet? The person at the head of a unit of the army. But there was nobody behind the people with the shofars. But they saw 32,000 people assembling as an army, and then suddenly they're surrounded by torches and shofar blasts. What do they assume happened? Is that 32,000 people had snuck up on them. They don't realize that nobody's there. Because it wasn't just, it wouldn't have been accomplished if they only had 300 people. It was only because they started with 32,000 people and then disbanded them that they played with the Midianites' assumptions. They thought, they were looking for an army, so they didn't even notice 300 people surrounding them. But then when the 300 people showed up, they assumed that without seeing it, 32,000 people had tricked them and were standing behind them. So he used strategy to play with their heads, so they ended up killing each other and fleeing. So you see that third element, yeah. Yeah, so that's definitely, you get that in all the Jewish battles that they're doing. Right, they break the honor code, yes. They do. Correct, and they do, and that's how they win, right? And you're right, they do. I don't know how to answer that, except that, you know, that's what they did. But I think you see it time and time again, right, that the message of David and Goliath, or the story of Gideon, or Esther, or the Maccabees, is that the underdog is a mirage. Right, the underdog can pull ahead if he has three things: if he has motivation, right, if he can think out of the box, and in theological terms, if he has God on his side. And especially if you mix those, right, that you take someone who's motivated and who realizes God on his side, but recognizes and needs to put in his own effort, so he thinks out of the box. If you combine those elements, then the notion of an underdog is just a mirage. It doesn't really exist, right? Underdog is all relative. It's all depending on the battlefield. And I think that's really the messages, and that the tropes that come out of the stories, right, is that A, is always think out of the box, right? B, make sure to have motivation. Also, remember that as long as God is on your side, right, you're not really the underdog. I'll just throw this out and for you to think about, but we can't get into it now, is that the Midrash adds a fourth lesson to this story. Is they assume that Goliath is the descendant of Orpah, right? So they say, so at that moment of Rut and Orpah, right, Rut goes and accepts being Jewish and therefore ends up being the great-grandmother of David, and Orpah turns her back on Ruth, even though it's totally understandable, but she ends up, you know, being the grandmother of Goliath. And I think at least one of the messages that the Midrash is doing there is to highlight that every decision we have that we make has a consequence, but also that extreme evil like Goliath doesn't necessarily start as extreme evil, right? You know, Hannah Arendt has a book, right, The Banality of Evil, right? She coins the phrase the banality of evil. That sometimes simply, right, doing just not caring enough eventually spirals out of control. I think they're already pointing that direction, right? That David and Goliath are like these, you know, archetypes of good versus evil, but it started, according to the Midrash, with a simple decision to not be willing to sacrifice. And that's, I think, just another lesson from the story, is that evil doesn't need to start with radical evil, right? Even making a slight wrong decision can have consequences. We should keep that in mind. So that's just a really a discussion for another time, but just to throw that out. Okay. So next week...